you know, the problem when you have 20 cloud-based software tools is all the information sits in 20 different places, and it's hard to actually figure out what goes on. And when you join that together, you generate metrics that you couldn't otherwise see. So just an example, what's the lifetime value of a customer that buys this product in their first purchase? You know, that doesn't exist in Shopify, or it doesn't exist in Amazon. So these are kind of metrics that you need to build by joining all this data together. And why is that important? Well, if, you know, if you're a furniture store, for example, and you sell a chair that results in loads of subsequent purchases, you know, that chair is more valuable than just the chair.
It takes courage and belief in yourself and your business idea to take the step to set up your own business. In the early stages, entrepreneurship can be a lonely road, even through those milestone moments. Deciding to commit to the idea you've been mulling over, learning, growing, and developing your skills, building a team to help you along the way, preparing to launch into new markets. Enterprise Ireland is there for all of those startup moments. From providing advice and guidance to new founders through our startup network, to pre-seed funding and early investment, we're here to help bring your ambition to fruition. To find out how Enterprise Ireland can help you on your startup journey, visit enterprise-ireland.com. Time's running out. Windows 10 support ends this October. That means no updates, no more security patches. That is a major risk for you and your business. But Nostra is helping you and your business upgrade. Book your free consultancy call. Simply click the link in the description below the podcast episode. Before we dive into today's episode, I want to share a game changer for your business, Azure Communications. When it comes to print and marketing solutions, these folks, led by CEO Jenny Johnston, are the real deal. Whether you need an eye-catching brochure, sleek business cards, or a full-blown digital campaign, Azure Communications has you covered. They're not just about high-quality prints or digital campaigns, they're also about delivering great results. And here's the best part. Just for listeners of The Entrepreneur Experiment, you can get 20% off your first order. Just give them a call or go online and use the code FOX20. With personalized service and fast turnaround times, Azure Communications will help you make the impact your business deserves. Trust me, when it comes to making your brand stand out, Azure Communications is the provider of choice. Check them out at azurecom.ie. Use code FOX20 and elevate your marketing game today.
Fran, welcome to the pod.
Thanks, Gary. It's lovely to be here.
A fellow Wicklow, I was going to say man, but kind of, they'd call us blow-ins.
Yeah, blow-ins. We're slowly getting accepted into the community.
I reckon about 20 years. Yeah. I was asking a neighbour and I was like, how long are you here? And he's like, 15 years. They still don't think I'm local. I was like, fair enough. How is the form?
Great. Yeah, I'm loving the summer. Just moving into a new house soon. So that's quite exciting. So
that is very exciting. Yeah. Perfect time to do it as well.
Totally, yeah. And the sun is shining outside, which is great.
And it's a Friday. I love recording on Fridays. Yeah. It's my favorite day to record. Everyone's in good form. Yeah. Sun's shining. Yeah. Ben's in good form. Everyone's happy.
Best of weather. You can't help us. Yeah.
What do you do?
I am the CEO and co-founder of an analytics business called Conjura. So we kind of help e-commerce businesses grow profitability and essentially just drive overall growth to their business.
So I think a lot of people would have heard of you over the last kind of couple of years as kind of like Wayflyer spun out, but then e-com become really prominent and kind of you're constantly brought up in the conversation when it comes to e-com in Ireland. Yeah. So kind of like give me kind of the backstory then on Conjura. So like how did this start?
Sure. So my co-founder who you've had on the show, I think Aidan Corbett. Mm-hmm. So Aidan was in, I was in Accenture Analytics at the time and Aidan had bootstrapped his own first business called Cubico. And his business was just training corporates on advanced modeling. So he saw a lot of gaps on, you know, analytics in different businesses and decided he'd set up a consulting company with me where we would go into companies and essentially like do some high level analytics. Probably these are small to medium companies in the UK and Ireland. And our goal was probably to find some idea to productize over time. So we worked with insurance companies, you know, private equity, all sorts of B2B businesses at the time. And after about a year and a half of doing consulting, we worked for one Irish e-com business who kind of had a problem in that they had data everywhere and they didn't really know what was going on in their business. And they got us in to build a bespoke data solution, really. And when we did that, we realized how valuable it was and how repeatable it was. And from there, I guess we hired some engineers and started building the first MVP of what Conjura is today.
So, I love that. Yeah. I think that's one of the best ways to build a business. It's just figure it out. Experiment. Yeah. Like, I call the podcast After Experiments because that's how I believe business works.
Yeah.
Like, you just experiment and you do it in someone else's time. Even better. The ultimate golden secret, experiment with someone else's time and money. But I think that's the only way it works, if there's skin in the game. If you're kind of micking around with whiteboards and stuff,
yeah,
you'll never really take it that seriously and you'll never really have any data like to play with.
And like, we even built a sort of mini pharma data product before the e-commerce version. And it was really good, but we realized that pharma took about 12 months to make a decision. So it was selling software or anything into pharma is really difficult. So, you know, we quickly identified we had a good idea and a good product, but it's just a bad customer profile. So whereas retailers or e-commerce businesses make decisions really quickly. So you could talk to them today and they could sign you up tomorrow.
I love that.
Yeah.
Break that down for me, actually, because I think that's a really good kickoff point. So when I'm recording the pod, I like to think of people who are listening, who are kind of maybe like noodling an idea or who are kind of like thinking about something. Oh, I'd love to do my own thing. When you and Aidan were kind of like looking at all these different options, what was like your ideal business model to build? Like, what were you kind of going, I'd like it to be this, this, and this? You've kind of give a great example there of why pharma was a bad one. So what were you looking for that then when you came to e-com, you were like, ah, that's it, that ticks the boxes?
Sure. So I guess we wanted a recurring revenue business, you know, that was like essentially a SaaS product that was pretty much self-serve. That was always our mission from the start. But equally, we love to have a customer that makes decisions quickly. So retail is tough, and we can talk about that in a while. You know, margins are tight and it's, you know, susceptible to lots of macroeconomic stuff. But retailers on the whole are always looking for an edge. And because of that, they make decisions really quickly. So, you know, we love the fact that the sales cycle was very short, or can be short anyway, not always. but... Yeah, and your customers aren't afraid to make, you know, innovative decisions. So, you know, really brands that were quite established were not afraid to take a punt on a startup, software startup, because it might give them an edge. So, yeah.
I think that's really interesting. You know, you didn't talk about the product and stuff there. You talked about the customer.
Yeah.
Especially in the early stages, people can get caught up building the product.
Totally.
And yeah. Thinking about it and thinking about it and thinking about it. Whereas for you, you were like, yeah, how quickly can they make the decision? That's often overlooked, like 90% of the time overlooked, because you kind of don't factor that in well, we're in deep trouble here if the sales cycle is 12 to 24 months.
Yeah.
And every 12 to 24 months, we're closing one or two customers. Like, the product has to be whopper.
Yeah. You've got to charge a lot of money.
Ticket size for that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So then when you kind of hit on it, what were your first kind of steps to building something that you wanted?
So I guess we're iterating all the time with operators. And I think one of the difficulties is some brands were obviously much better than others when it came to just execution. So, you know, as you're kind of building out your analytics solution, you're asking brands for feedback. You know, you're always getting their what they want to see on a daily basis. And sometimes they lead you in a really good direction because they're really on top of things. And other times, not so... They would take you down a road that really doesn't lead anywhere. And it's probably down to some weaker people in the companies that
you're... Is that they didn't know? They couldn't give you the answer because they didn't know?
I think sometimes they prioritize metrics or, you know, KPIs that are not actionable. So, you know, you might...
Okay.
They might really insist on, just an example, like, I really want to see my metrics by mobile versus desktop versus tablet. Now, this is more 4 or 5 years ago, but actually... How much you can do about that? You know, a consumer will buy how they buy, and you know, I don't think there's that much they can influence. You know, whether it's mobile or desktop. So, yeah, sometimes they'd really be on top of stuff that actually isn't very actionable. So, therefore, it shouldn't be a priority for them.
So you want to focus on data points that actually mattered, that moved the needle, that really was like a margin issue or, you know, return issue or something like that.
Yeah, and this is a big struggle for analytics tools in general. I think we, you know, at times your customer will say it was really nice, like we, you know, but is it doing a job for me? Is it automating something? And maybe I'm too busy to use it. And this is one of the big issues that we face all the time, is like we need to embed ourselves more in the day-to-day processes of a company, of our customers. And I think we can get onto it in a while, but I think AI is going to help us a lot with that. But you really want to be part of, you know, their day-to-day jobs and tasks, or else you're going to be in trouble down the line.
Is it hard to get people to tell you what's really happening? Do sometimes people tell you either what they think they should tell you or what they would like to be happening, as opposed to what's really happening in the business?
Yeah, like I think one difficulty you have is you have people in certain departments of a business. So you could have a merchandiser or a marketer or an e-commerce director, and they may not want their CEO to fully see the picture. So there's also that element of, you know, you're highlighting everything. And that's, if everyone has access to everything, that can be uncomfortable for some people, especially if their element of the business isn't performing.
Okay.
So I think more than, I think people are, they generally know what their role is, how is the role is doing, but they may want to not share that sometimes with their superiors or their managers.
So what was your first kind of moment where you were like, I think this is definitely the route we should be going down? Like when you say, right, we're going to go all in e-com, what was it? You mentioned there about like purchasing cycles, but what else was it about that kind of niche that you were like, yes, this is definitely a space we want to be kind of like nailing our colors to the mast in?
Yeah, like I think we were, you know, so think about it, we were 2018, we started building the first MVP of Conjura, and it was real e-com growth period, 2019, 2020. So it felt like there was a wave happening where more and more people are buying online. There was more need to figure out what's going on, you know, in terms of purchasing behavior, you know, consumer behavior. And we're getting great feedback from our customers. Like a lot of early customers that signed up didn't really understand what was happening in their business, and they were really excited to kind of get a deeper understanding of, oh my God, you know, this country and this channel and this product is doing really well. And I didn't really know, you know, when you're selling across multiple countries and multiple channels, what exactly was resonating. So it was a combination of great feedback from our customers and then the whole industry moving online, you know, the whole retail industry in general. So that, you know, that meant there was a lot more interest from traditional bricks and mortar businesses who wanted to develop their online website. So we had great customers, like we, you know, Kath Kitson, TM Lou, and a lot of brands that were getting more and more sales online and moving away from bricks and mortar.
And what were you building for them?
So we're building a full, essentially like control center. So we take data in from all their orders, their marketing tools, their website analytics tools, their warehouse, you know, and patching all that data together, essentially. So, you know, the problem when you have 20 cloud-based software tools is all the information sits in 20 different places, and it's hard to actually figure out what goes on. And when you join that together, you generate metrics that you couldn't otherwise see. So just an example, you know, what's the lifetime value of a customer that buys this product in their first purchase? You know, that doesn't exist in Shopify, or it doesn't exist in Amazon. So these are kind of metrics that you need to build by joining all this data together. And why is that important? Well, if, you know, if you're a furniture store, for example, and you sell a chair that results in loads of subsequent purchases, you know, that chair is more valuable than just the chair.
I get you.
You know, yeah. Whether if you
it's not it, in isolation yeah, anymore. It's not just Fran buying a chair. It's Fran, but then Fran comes back and buys it.
He loves the chair, so he's going to buy a lamp.
And he's then just he's bought a new house. Now he's going to furnish the house out. Yeah, I get you. Okay. So whereas, that was sitting in siloed. They'd probably see like a purchase over here. They wouldn't see the connecting dots between you and the first purchase.
Yeah, the sort of real value of a product could be different to what you think, you know. So
it sounds hard. That sounds like a hard build.
It is. And like I think the misconception, insights and analytics are probably the easy part. The hard part is the data wrangling and cleaning and joining. You know, data's messy, and you've got to just get into all these legacy systems. You've got to get it all out. You've got to standardize it. You've got to clean it. You've got to join it all together. That's the heavy lifting stuff that Conjura does really well. And then the sort of lovely layer on top, which is insights, you know, is almost the less challenging part. And that's, you know, but that's where all the value is for the, really for the brands.
And when you, were you building this for each individual customer, or did you build like a product and they all signed up to the same product?
So initially we built bespoke solutions for every customer, which, you know, we kind of needed to do really, A, to get these customers on board, we needed to be more open to any technology stack. And then B, we needed to figure out what customers really wanted. You know, so when we were building bespoke solutions, we were giving them exactly what they asked for, and that gave us a good idea of what they need.
Okay, yeah. Because then it shapes your decisions about what you build in the future, right? Because if you, if you build all this, those stuff you made, the point you made earlier about like what's really important versus what's actually important, what you think is important.
So once we built probably 30 or 40 different bespoke solutions, and at the end of that, you know, the scalability of that was never going to work because we needed to hire people every time, you know, we needed to grow this big team of builders essentially. But we had a great view across all these brands, and we said, okay, well, now we know what best in class looks like. Let's make that a product that works with this tech stack only, you know, so if you're in this tech stack, this product will work for you. If you're not, it's not going to work for you. And use all of our learnings across all these customers and pick the best of everything.
I love that. So you've iterated. So you've experimented every single stage. The first stage was kind of experimenting with loads of different ideas across different sectors. Then you nailed down a sector.
Yeah.
Then you went into the sector, experimented across the sector, then found the winning formula there, and then built out the final product.
Absolutely.
That's like, that's as close to a perfect roadmap. I know you're going to laugh because like, I'm sure that was an absolute nightmare, but that's kind of the roadmap I think a lot of companies should be going, because people are, especially in early stages, they're like, oh, I'm going to build out this solution. And start building and building and building with no data points, with no customers, with no kind of real industry expertise. And I know there's this like myth of like, oh yeah, people from new industries should go into like totally different industries because they'll have a fresh perspective. Valid to a point, but how the hell can they know really what a retailer doing 20 million euros a year, servicing the UK market, big in women's wear, how that moves the needle? On what moves the needle? Because I hear this from founders all the time. You know, what we thought would work in Manchester didn't work in London.
Yeah.
So like, extrapolate that out across e-com.
Yeah.
You're running the whole spectrum. Like, so I think having that data is unbelievable. So the customization then become the product.
Yeah.
How did you bridge that gap between doing one-off projects? Because I was literally having a voice note with a friend of mine this morning. He's kind of in that, like, he's doing, going to build one-off projects. And I was like, just be careful, because the more you do with that, you become a consultant.
Yeah.
And I was like, it's definitely good for data, but I'd say get the data, niche down as quickly as possible, and then just build for them, because it can be quite time-consuming.
It's hard. And this is where I give a warning to anybody on follow that path that I went on is, you know, we eventually had to split the company into people that were running that old business and maintaining it. And, you know, almost the last few customers that were onboarding and building those, and then the people that were building the new product. And the new product looked way sexier. So you had to convince people to stay in one side over the other. And you're kind of concurrently running two businesses then, which is, you know, which is not ideal. So we got amazing learnings, but we had this operational headache as we became a product company instead of a kind of a services led company. So that's the tricky path to go down. And, you know, and in the end, you need a smaller team as well as you go down that path, because you don't need all these people building. So, you know, you've got to kind of contract and become just a very product focused team over time.
What were your key learnings then, moving from, say, service consultancy to product? Like, what were you kind of going, if I was going to do that now again, let's speak to all the kind of people who want to build out a product company. Maybe they've been doing exactly what you were doing. What are the key learnings that you know now that you might have like wasted a bit of time and money at the time?
I think, you know, definitely it was easier to sell a bespoke solution. So we had a huge confidence in our ability to sell an analytics solution, you know, because we'd done it really successfully. But we were selling whatever you want solution. You know, when it comes down, kind of comes back to like, this is what you're getting. And I know you want this two other things over here, but don't forget about that. You know, this is what you're getting. that becomes more challenging because it's kind of like you're getting 80% of what you really want. And trust us, like, this is really what you need to focus on.
Yeah.
That becomes challenging. So I think, you know, shifting the sales process into a more, you know, product-based sales process and not saying, like, you want that custom feature, I'll talk to my engineers, we might be able to sneak it in. You have to cut that out. And that's, you know, that's a discipline that took time to remove from the company, I'd say.
And that's the temptation for everyone when you're starting out. Like, yeah, you'll kind of say yes to any crazy request because you're like, another one in the door.
Yeah. And look, every startup has this kind of, you know, we all did it, where you kind of sell the future roadmap. And just to an extent, we would still do that sort of today. And then that we'll say, like, this stuff is coming soon, you know, whether, like, we don't connect to Temu, but we have brands talking to us, hey, you know, you guys connect to Walmart and eBay and TikTok and Amazon. When are you going to do Temu? And I'd say, look, it's coming very soon. You know, just if you onboard with us, it'll be imminent. You know, you're still always kind of doing that to an extent, but that's a banker for us because it's not a big custom thing. It's just something that we will do anyway.
Do you wait then until the pull is so big?
Yeah.
So instead of kind of like building out this big bloated product, do you wait then until, you know, customers are screaming for it?
Yeah, like I'd say when we do a new integration like that, we normally have 8 or 10 brands who are asking for it at that stage. So we're like, okay, look, that's just, you know, we've hit a critical mass now of brands who really want this. And they're usually already customers. Sometimes they might be leads in the funnel. And then when we get that, it sort of bumps up the list in our priority.
If you were speaking to Fran of like 22, you started doing the switchover, was it?
Yeah.
So if you're speaking to Fran of 22, what would be the kind of key lessons? You're like, look, I know you're going to want to do this, but don't do that. What are the kind of key, as you've become now service to product? Because I think this is a really interesting kind of like thing to pick apart, because it's kind of the holy grail for every service product or every service company is like, let's build a product because we can build it once and sell it 100 times, that whole thing. What's the kind of key things that Fran of 22 should be doing?
I think we were building two sort of things concurrently at one stage, and that was a mistake. You know, we should just relentlessly focusing on one would be crucial.
You were building two products, is it, or what do you mean?
No, so we had a product and we had a sort of a side use case for the product. So we had customers back in the day who were private equity customers, and our product was able to develop or was able to spit out a PDF or a PowerPoint presentation, which was like an analysis of a business. Just, you know, the same data, it was producing like almost like a DD of a business.
Before ChatGPT became a thing.
Yeah.
They lazily go into you and go, I've done this new report, boss. For that, for any business or e-com businesses?
E-com businesses. So,
okay.
We had VC customers and, you know, so who were paying good money for that.
That's a cool product.
Yeah. So we're building our main product and then we're iterating on this because it was driving good revenue. Mm. And we should have just focused relentlessly on the big products in hindsight. So, and actually, totally, as you said, I mean, we're leaning into, and we can, you know, leaning into this kind of agentic AI. You can now generate a report like that by just asking our data set with AI. So it's kind of, thank God we didn't focus on that anymore, because you can produce that now with just a prompt.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, isn't it? Like, because if you'd spent the last 3 years building that, you'd never
be in trouble.
Uh-oh.
Yeah.
No, you probably would have seen it coming and been able to pivot. So as you built out then, what was the kind of key decisions you made to bring the customers with you and kind of translate that? I suppose I did a retreat last weekend and it was to like 50 entrepreneurs and the biggest issue. So I went around the room and asked every single one, what's your biggest problem? And I don't mean, it's a bit of a problem. I mean, your hair on fire. This is an existential crisis problem. And probably 40% of them said clarity of messaging. And these are, some of them were quite established businesses and they still didn't have clarity of messaging because, you know, the last couple of years have been quite crazy and people have kind of like shifted their business model and things are happening. So how did you message this to customers existing and new? How'd you go, look, we were this and now we're this?
Yeah, like I guess what we're doing wasn't that different, you know, so like the, the product was just a more out of the box version of the customized version. So like, I think more importantly is how are we going to pick our lane, you know, when it came to e-commerce analytics. So we focused around Shopify initially because Shopify is huge. It's over 2 million merchants, a big TAM. And the Shopify analytics space itself was competitive. So you kind of have, within Shopify, within that world, you nearly have to differentiate yourself. And that's where we saw where e-commerce was getting more fragmented. We talked about this before, but you know, the Western world is kind of following the Chinese model where you're selling your product on lots of social platforms, on, you know, through influencers. So you're almost going from one channel, which is Shopify, to 10 channels, to 20 channels. And we decided in Conjure that we're going to back that journey and we're going to connect to all the marketplaces and all these other channels and start building a solution that's really tailored for multi-channel businesses. So that was the big bet, I would say, as we sort of wanted to get more niche in within a competitive landscape.
I had a customer, podcast guest in yesterday, and all his business is through Meta.
Yeah.
Everything. The whole kit and caboodle. I was like, that is wild.
Yeah.
And he's doubling it down and doubling down and doubling down, like creating, like we were creating 10 pieces of content, now 30, now 400. You know, like this social model, like again, the episode that went live yesterday when we're recording this was Kat and Killian from Luxury Exchange.
Yeah.
Kat goes live twice a day.
Yeah.
On Insta.
Yeah.
And that's her primary sales channel.
Yeah.
It's fascinating. Like you said, that Chinese model of social selling.
I think,
you know, people talked about it a couple of years ago and we all kind of poo-pooed it a bit, but TikTok has kind of just hammered that home to the fore, like, of like, yeah, this
content,
is
yeah.
content. Content. Yeah. And I said this at the retreat at the weekend. I said it to a friend of mine this morning. I was like, companies need to be thinking about their media arm. What is your media function? Because people just think of sales and marketing.
Yeah.
You know, traditionally, like sales marketing.
Yeah.
And that would cover everything, right? Whereas now I think media has to be a part of your business. You have to look at your, what's your media function?
Yeah. I mean, like for me, there's almost two avenues. So there's the content side, which is critical and obviously can be really cost effective because, you know, you mightn't pay for anything. You could be just generating great videos. And then the other side is more, you know, back to the old, like, I guess, ad targeting, which, you know, is very saturated within Google and Meta, but there are opportunities now in some of the new channels. So like if you're a furniture store, you can sell your products on B&Q now. And actually like it's not that competitive to bump your product up on a B&Q website. So there's, you know, there's areas that are probably they're not competitive right now that you can get great value that will soon be competitive again. So you have to find new channels, find areas of opportunity, experiment, then that will become saturated and then you got to find something else. And
well, the only thing constant is change, right?
Yeah.
I was chatting this with someone yesterday and like, you know, the cycles used to be quite long. The cycles of change used to be, you know, 3 to 5 years. Now it's about 12 months.
Yeah.
In certain industries, it's quicker, you know, and you see the AI stuff, which we'll jump in now in a while. But what else? Bring me back to kind of like that transition across, because I think this is really interesting. You've effectively built three companies simultaneously. You've kind of built one, then two, then three versions of the same product. How did you, like, did you raise cash to do that? Or how did you manage to essentially start a new company within a company?
Yeah, like, initially we took on some seed capital with high net worths who were, you know, amazingly supportive throughout our journey, actually.
At the very start, was it?
Yeah, pretty much at the very start. Like, the consulting pre-Conjura, pre the e-commerce products, was we were washing our own face. So we were obviously just building solutions, you know, the pharma, for example, we were able to generate revenue through our consulting so that we were just able to pay ourselves a modest salary. At the time, there was only three of us, so Aiden, myself, and Ronan. And then when we got into the e-com world and we started hiring engineers, we needed some investment. So we generated some convertible loan notes and we got some great investors in. And they really tied us over all through the even split of Wayflyer to the point where Conjura got some institutional capital from VCs. And then that was in 2022. And then from then on, you know, we've been supported by our VCs, luckily, to keep on growing.
Mustache, you've kind of just flagged a to-do for me. I need to go back and re-interview Aidan because I interviewed him in the most bizarre of circumstances. It was just kind of during COVID. It was like one of those kind of like, we're in lockdown, we're not in lockdown. It was me and him sitting in the basement on Bagot Street in the empty, the bar that used,
to be.
Just me and him sitting there. And it was like, it's like the, you know, it's like this bizarre scene of like a zombie movie. Yeah. There was no one in the street. There was no one in the building. It was just me with a bag of like, with a bag of gear on my back, a microphone. And I sat the microphone down. It was before all the video and everything. It was bizarre.
Wow.
That was a great chat because it was kind of, it was just on the start of the come up. Like there was, I think that was 21, I'm gonna say.
Okay, wow, yeah.
So it was maybe, yeah, I think early 21, so just at the start of like, I heard about these Wayflower guys. And then 12 months later, it was just like,
you got in there early then,
I pick him, right? That's part of it. But not, you know, and he was so good about it. Like it was incredible because like to do stuff in person back then was brilliant. Like, so how, then you've kind of had a change again, like Aidan then kind of like went to build Wayflower as well. So how did you manage all that?
Yeah, it was a great question. So we started lending from Conjura at the time because we saw these great businesses who had, if you know, we could sit on their data and they even their marketing returns were excellent, but they just had a working capital issue. So we said, like, this was predominantly Jack Pierce coming in saying, hey guys, you should look at this. Like, I think your analytics engine would suit this kind of underwriting business. So we started lending out to a few of our Conjura customers as an experiment. That went well. And then we decided, well, you can't have a fintech business and a SaaS business. It's too confusing.
Okay.
So we kind of split them to give both an opportunity because different investor profiles.
Interesting. That was good awareness though, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think we were well advised probably at the time as well. You know, more like an investor view in of saying like, if you wanted to be a bit of a SaaS business, bit of a lending, it's going to be confusing. But the tricky part was getting our investors at the time, this was pre-VC money, to give us the opportunity to essentially separate the company in two, split the team in two, and have two bites of the cherry, really, which...
How did you feel about that? Because it's quite a big decision. Like, I'm loving this conversation of breaking down all the different bits of the business, because I think it's so interesting, because it's perfect when people like you come in, because people will look at you in the outside and go, oh, yeah, Conjura, a big business, blah, blah, blah. But then to break it down into its component parts and see all the decisions that went into it along the way, it's absolutely fascinating. So as you were thinking about splitting out Conjura, then what was your personal thought process behind it?
Yeah, I mean, like, I really enjoyed working with Aidan. We're good friends. It was, you know, and I definitely had a apprehension about like going our, like splitting it up in that way and then bringing the team on board. Cause we had to agree then who in the team was going to go in which direction, which was also tricky, right? Some people
pick your favorite parent.
Yeah. So
who wants to spend the weekend with dad?
Yeah. So like, I think, but remember at the time, like, I guess Conjura had traction, you know, we had customers, we had Wayflower was really an idea, you know, so Wayflower was probably a bigger risk. And then personally, you know, it was a personal hedge, I guess, because we gave everyone who's in Conjura shares in Wayflower. So that was, you know, everybody essentially had a chance now if either succeeded. Yeah,
I like that. Yeah.
And the investors got, again, we split the cap table. So they had shares in both the original investors. Yeah.
Okay. That's interesting.
So everybody had, you know, had two rolls of the dice, I guess. And from that side, it was, you know, that was exciting, I guess, to see which, if one would succeed or both or, you know.
Could you have imagined how well Wayflower would do?
No, it's like it's a one in a million, you know, it really is. And it's just the right place at the right time. Great team and everything else, you know, but it's just, you know, for that to happen in such a fast space of time, it's so unusual anywhere in the world. Like even in Silicon Valley, it's really unusual.
So, what did it feel like?
Well, like, I suppose I wasn't, you know, like, once we separated, I was just an outsider looking in. Yeah. So
that's what I'm curious, right? Because like,
no, I
chatted
excited
to Jack and Aidan, and they both have had different experiences, obviously. And then they, you know, they've seen the come up and they saw the other side, whereas you kind of saw it at the start. And then I was kind of curious how you'd feel watching it.
Yeah, like, look, it wasn't an ounce of begrudgery, you know. I was delighted, obviously. I was personally invested in it.
Yeah, so, of course.
But yeah, thrilled. I mean, for everybody involved, you know, it was very exciting story for Ireland. And you do want Irish companies to succeed and, you know, make a name for the country as well. So
huge.
Yeah. Like, I mean, I was just far enough away not to have FOMO because I didn't really feel the excitement. You know, you're sort of outside looking in, you get update here and there, but you don't really understand like the day to day, like, oh my God, we signed this customer. And you know, you're not getting that level of granularity, which is good in a way, because that would make it hard. If you're really feeling every win, you know, you'd be more sort of inclined to want to join.
Yeah. And I suppose you never know what's lurking within your own business as well. Yeah. This is a really good lesson of always being, I suppose you're into analytics. So like be always being analytical, like we talked about earlier, yeah. But like you can, there's little gems in the data you can miss if you yeah. just aren't paying attention. So with Conjura then, what was your kind of like your mission? So you're like, okay, let's split these two companies. What did you want Conjura to be?
Like we wanted to bring world-class analytics to small to medium businesses, really. So, you know, if you're a Nike, you've got 50 deep team of analytics people and they're doing brilliant work and you've got exciting models. I mean, that's very achievable for a 5-man business. You know, it's very productizable. And we wanted to deliver that to essentially small businesses, medium businesses, where they could compete with anybody, any size, because it's very productizable, as I said.
Yeah. Okay, so you were giving big company tools that you would have built from massive companies, but productizing that down and making it accessible into smaller businesses.
Yeah,
yeah, it's a pretty compelling sales as well. It's a pretty compelling story.
One thing that people probably don't realize is you can't do this in B2B land. So B2B world, the data sources are quite bespoke. You know, you've got Salesforce and HubSpot, and they all have kind of different ways of, you know, I suppose configuring them. They'll have different fields. So you couldn't build a Conjura for B2B because every B2B company has totally different stuff, different data.
Okay.
Whereas a B2C company has a very standard order. You know, everything goes through like a payment, and, you know, it's something that's achievable, but
it's uniform data across the way. You're getting to see all the same kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Thousands and thousands and yeah. thousands of times.
Yeah.
And then as you kind of like built it out, what were the kind of landmarks where you're like, okay, this is actually going to work? Because I know you've built multiple businesses, but you're kind of building a new one within an existing one. So at what stage you're like, okay, I think this is going to work?
Yeah, I think we're still always...
I'll tell you when I get there.
Yeah, always feeling like we need to do better. So I wouldn't say we definitely feel like, you know, you've ever made it, but... Getting, you know, we got some great partners on board. So we pretty early on got Sage, you know, the accountancy firm, yeah. essentially. They acquired an ERP system called RightPro, which is it's an ERP system for mid-market e-commerce businesses.
What's ERP mean?
So, I don't know what they're...
No, not even the initials, but what does it mean to the person on the street who doesn't work in e-com? What does system do?
It sits behind Shopify and essentially... automates all the order handling. So, you know, when an order goes in through Shopify, it would take the order, create labels for warehouses, and it automates a lot of the jobs that happen after that.
Yeah.
That would have, if you're a small business without an ERP, it's all manual stuff.
You're printing the label, you're sticking it on, you're going to the warehouse, you're pulling off the Moleskine notebook.
So order management, inventory management, warehouse management, all that stuff is kind of piled into that tool. So Sage had this tool that they bought, and they wanted to layer on our analytics on top of it. So they white labeled our product. It's called Sage Retail Analytics, and they sell it under their branding.
Okay.
So they kind of resell us to lots of their big, and they have big distribution because they have big global customer
base.
Yeah,
huge. They were a sponsor. That's interesting.
Yeah.
So I didn't actually realize that was a part of the business.
Yeah. So we've leaned in hard to the ERP world and these big ERP businesses, and partnering with them and them reselling our products is a kind of a big part of what we are today.
Oh, yeah, amazing. So like you're not having to go out and do individual sales on every single one. Some of them come through resellers then.
Yeah.
You kind of touched on it there, but who's your ideal customer? Like when people are kind of like going, oh, I wonder what kind of people should use this.
Yeah, like I think an e-commerce brand or a merchant who's doing anywhere from 5 million to 100 million in turnover is usually where we operate. And usually they're selling across multiple channels. So not always, they could be just selling on Shopify, but Shopify and Amazon and eBay and Walmart. And often they've got a lot of SKUs. So, and with a lot of SKUs, you have a lot of complexity. So, you know, you're really trying to figure out where you're making your money. And, you know, if you have a huge catalog, often 20% of your catalog is really just generating 90% of your profit. So it's
the old 80-20 rule applies all the time.
All
isn't
the time. It's incredible.
So you're the data guy.
Yeah.
Let's dig into the data. Let's do like an e-com kind of like masterclass here for people. What is happening? I kind of want to go current and then go backwards.
Yeah.
What's happening in 2025? What are you seeing right now? You're getting all the data from all across the world. What are you seeing happening in e-com right now?
In the industry in general, is
it? Like what's happening in the industry? Like, is it booming? Is it on its knees? Is it somewhere in the middle? Like, what trends are emerging? All that.
So, it's a good question. Like, we sit on top of loads of brands, so I do look at this. Like, we anonymously aggregate the data of our brands, so we get a bit of a view of what the world looks like. So, I think there's more and more revenue going from marketplaces. So, you know, brands are leaning into selling across multiple channels. So I think for our customer base, 25% of revenue now comes from non-Shopify or BigCommerce, you know, non-website sales. So you're really starting to lean into other channels.
What's that, like social or what do you mean?
Yeah, it could be TikTok, could be Amazon, could be Walmart, could be, you know, anything outside of your own website. So that's one, and that's gone from, you know, if you look at a year ago, it's probably 18-19%. So it's just creeping up and taking more and more of your revenue share. In terms of territories, Europe is doing really well. The highest growth we see year on year is in Europe.
Interesting.
UK is still, you know, struggling. US is doing okay. I think US growth is probably on average about 10% year on year. Europe is 15-16%. So obviously, we've customers. We've some brands that are exploding. We've some brands that are plateauing. So it's, but on the whole, you know, it's 15% year on year growth is kind of an average.
So after obviously e-com during COVID was just bananas. Like we talked about the e-com or the Wayflyer story, where just things went crazy, right?
Yeah.
What happened after COVID? What was the reason there was such a slowdown in e-com?
He has a huge amount of stuff, I guess. One, so the algorithms changed on the ad platforms. So Facebook, for example, changed their algorithm. Maybe it was May 21, and it caused a massive increase in cost of acquiring new customers. So, and that was probably the whole Cambridge Analytica, you know, what data they could use, couldn't use with targeting, that really made a big difference to the effectiveness of your marketing spend. And then a lot of the freight issues. So, you know, we had, see, lockdown happened and there was a huge delay and increase in shipping. And so brands were paying way more to get freight shipped and, you know, sent across from China. So there was a lot of operational headaches, I think, for quite a while, which caused huge supply chain issues. And then there was, I think, basically huge influx of new brands, and the competition just was relentless. Yeah. New brands all the time. The barrier to entry is so low now. You know, you can set up a Shopify store on your own or on your couch for quite a small, maybe $5,000 or $10,000. And, you know, so with that low barrier to entry, just new store after new store after new store. So, you know, if you're in an area that's doing okay, you could have 10 competitors just pop up around you very quickly. And, you know, it's so global as well. So it's just, just a lot of competition, problems with ad spend, ad platforms, and then I think a lot of, you know, operational supply chain issues as well.
So a load of different things, and then people opening up and suddenly kind of going, I just want to go back to the shop. And
the shop's opening up for sure. Like, it took there's a big rebound in bricks and mortar revenue. And then, you know, people, as I said to you before, retail is like, you know, property, it's cyclical. So you have 7-8 year cycles where you've got a dip and people are just not spending money. You know, it's interest rates, everything else rises, and consumers just start saving again and they're not spending. So you're totally vulnerable to all these kind of outside factors.
What's happening in 2025 then? Are what stage of the cycle do you reckon are we at? Are people spending? Are they holding? Are they not?
I think we're like the tariff disruption aside, we're on the way back up. So more spending again. And, you know, I feel like we've hit, our dip was probably the end of 22, first half of 23, and we're steadily growing back out of it. And then, you know, still some disruptions, but on the whole, it's on the rise again. Yeah.
And what kind of like, obviously it's anonymized data, but like what, from your kind of like personal experience, what is really working in e-com right now? Like what kind of sectors, I suppose, are really working? Like what companies are killing it in e-com right now?
Yes, I think it's like, it's quite hard to put your finger on that. It's, you know, it's quite a mystery. Like if you think about it, it's, you know, it's consumer behavior. You never predict how people behave. Human behavior is crazy. Like we have businesses come in that are, you know, like you could have a ladder business that's growing really well for whatever reason. It's just, you know, I don't know whether they've just got better ladders out there and better products and people are doing a lot of DIY stuff. You have, I mean, you know, I would have said a couple of years ago, obviously beauty, skincare, pets, all, you know, brilliant businesses, a lot of repeat purchase behavior. They're very competitive as well. So, you know, you've got some work, some don't. And we've just got so many obscure brands coming in and selling stuff that I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't even be on my radar that are doing really well. It's hard. It's always hard to predict.
Are things getting more niche? As in, like, is there more niches? Whereas before it used to be like, you know, big online stores, like are customers able to, like, you said it there, like people are able to set up companies very quickly, which is great for the consumer, difficult for their competitors. But like, is there more niche brands popping up?
I think so. Yeah. I think some could be just a good idea that, you know, maybe you copy from the US and you set up a business, similar business in Europe, or some can just be a really cool brand that people just love. You know, it's just the story you're telling or association is, it's more about people identify with it. So it's not, maybe not reinventing something, but it's just a trend, I guess, that's fashionable.
Yeah. And as people are listening to this and they're either in e-com or they want to set up in like 25, 26, what are the kind of key things they must be doing? What do you see as like best in practice? These, when I see good clients coming on, they all do this.
So like there's different, I guess we have customers who grow through a lot of hustle. So they could grow like through amazing content production and stuff that's, you know, it's hard to predict that you can be good at that, you know, or maybe it's a content person that actually puts a product under a name. Other brands are very process driven. So they could be just, they know how to execute a good retail, you know, business, and they know how to be efficient at ordering products and selling the right margin and advertising in the right way. So those businesses are methodical founders. Other businesses are, you know, very creative founders, and they're so different, I guess. It's hard to know, you know, whether
there's no one way.
Yeah. There's no one way.
You can pick your strength, lean hard into it.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay. And then you kind of said it earlier about AI and kind of like the rise of AI. And a lot of it is kind of like, you know, there's a lot of noise, right?
Yeah.
So how do you pick through the signal and the noise? Like, where are you seeing, as someone who is kind of like the eyes on the ground of what's happening, where are you seeing that AI will make a huge impact?
Yeah. So like, you know, even I guess I was skeptical at the start looking at the application to data in my world, and my mind is blown, I have to say. So, you know, the initial LLM stuff, I guess the application, people were asking questions of their data. So you picture Conjura creates this amazing data set. You know, we join all this data together and you have an operator saying, tell me about my best 5 products in the UK last month. Like, that to me wasn't that exciting. You know, you can get an answer that you don't have to go in and look at a table or a chart, but it's not exciting. But now, probably from December last year, the agentic stuff, so you can ask a much more vague question. So tell me where my business is strong and where my business is weak and where the risks are. And that will generate probably a query that has 200 different questions underneath it.
Okay.
And that query will go through, you know, you'll see it load up, and it will generate generally like a 20-page report about your business, which has...
from 3 simple prompts, yeah.
Really, really kind of obviously accurate data on what it's saying about your business, but then a lot of opinion as well. So it's pulling out recommendations and opinions that blew my mind. Like, you know, we're so excited. We're running to our customers saying, here, we're building this, you know, have a look and say, what do you think about what they're saying you should do with your business? You know, because we're obviously saying,
does this sound like you?
I mean, are they right in saying that you should do X, Y, and Z? And, you know, our customers are like equally blown away by what its ability to do. So, you know, it's actually quite more opinionated than I really thought it would be. You know, it's not just giving you back facts, but giving you back, you know, this is what we would say, these are the products you should look at pricing. These are the products you should think about promoting more on your website. Now, where does that go next? And that's even more exciting to me. So we have in Conjura now, on top of our data, we'd have, it's called an MCP, but it's like a little, you essentially have your agent sitting on it. And your agent could connect to another agent that's, say, sitting on Amazon or sitting on Shopify. This is where the future is going. And you can tell, you can say, hey, Conjura agent, tell me the 10 products that need their prices changed on Amazon based on your margin data, because we have better margin data than Amazon have, and send that to Amazon and tell Amazon to change the price. So now you have the full automation. So, you know, Conjura agent would say, here's 10 products and here's the 10 new prices. And Amazon would go, okay, I'll change those prices for you. And that's where, you know, that's incredible development. So the actual jobs that you'd have to do on top of Conjura data now, you'll be able to tell AI to do it. And that's where I think it's going to be a massive change.
So you remove the friction. Anywhere you move friction is valuable.
Well, it's kind of like you could have a CFO or a CEO now sitting there without a middle person almost saying, you know, tell me what campaigns in Meta I should change and go and change it. You know, it's almost like that. Because
The knowledge, the information in itself, while interesting, is kind of useless unless you do something with it. Like information without execution is useless, right? You're like, oh, that's a good report. Yeah, great. And then it just sits there in your email unopened. So for you, when you say agentic, like, what does that mean? It's you kind of explained it nicely there, but I just want to kind of like broaden it out for people who've kind of no AI experience. What are they doing? Like, they're like little, that's like it's like having a head of marketing and then a marketing person over here is actually doing the changes. Like, how does it work?
Yeah. So like, I suppose originally when LLM came out and AI came, you know, I said originally as in a year and a half ago, you had to be very,
back in the old days of AI,
you had to be very specific on what you asked, you know, and there was a lot of skill in like, you nearly create a hard paragraph to say, look at this, don't look at that.
Yeah.
Exclude this, don't give me that.
And, the you know, nuance
just,
wasn't there.
Yeah, it's quite, and you had to iterate on it. So you'd write a request and you go, oh, actually it's giving me that and I don't want it. So, you know, remove the orders that were refunded or, you know, whatever you had to say. Now you're essentially asking a much higher level question and you're trusting that you're asking AI the question and it's able to take that question and really break it down into the right underlying questions. And it doesn't need really specific questions. You know, if you say, like, what are the risks to my business? You know, it will figure out, okay, I need to look at the customers. I need to look at the products. I need to look at the margin. I need to look at your warehouse. I'm going to look at everything. You don't need to tell me what to look at. I'm going to look at everything and I'm going to figure out which of them are the weakest parts of your business. I'm going to tell you then.
How does it know that?
It's just, I guess it's learning all the time from the original questions. It's a good point. I mean, I haven't dived into that deep layer, but you know, maybe it's learning from all the subset of questions. Or I'm actually not sure.
Learning more about you. Yeah. I did this prompt thing at the weekend with ChatGPT, and I was like, you know, we've talked a lot. You know me quite well now. Where are my 5 blind spots?
Yeah,
and it was scary.
Yeah,
it was a right on the money. Like all the things you think at night to yourself, but like don't actually action.
Yeah,
I was like, ah, yeah, you're bang on all of those.
Yeah,
and it's just because it's just knows me over the last like whatever it is, 12, 18 months I've been using it. It's phenomenal. But like these are the kind of lessons because AI is talked about a lot, right? And people are building like features, not products, right?
Yeah.
They're building little things that sit on top. But it's kind of when I see real And you nailed it there earlier when you said it's all about psychology. It's all about our psychology and how we use these things. It's only when I see examples of that, I'm like, so it's just getting smarter on me. It's getting smarter on the human condition. Yeah, we're all largely the same. Our psychologies are largely the same. We're all driven by largely the same motivations. But being able to give me personal feedback on the things that I'm personally either falling down on or need to action on or, you know, an opportunity for me, that's very, very powerful for a person. But for a business, it's an absolute game changer. Like, and this agentic thing, I think people aren't understanding it because it's now become a word, right?
Yeah.
People are now afraid to go, what the hell does that mean?
I suppose it's like having a personal PA, personal assistant who, you know, you can just say, here, book me a holiday. And they know that means flights, accommodation, taxis, you know, sites. Yeah. They'll know all the subtasks.
Like Jarvis from Iron Man.
Yeah.
I was like, when it's as good as Jarvis, then we'll know we've hit like peak AI. When it just goes, oh, good morning, Gary. Here's what you're doing today. Da, 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 da. Because we're still like, a lot of stuff's very rudimentary.
Yeah.
A lot of stuff we do is still very much like our two thumbs.
Yeah.
Like going like this. And you're like, the humans are actually the issue now. We're the blocker of like sitting there with our phone. Whereas when I got ChatGPT voice, I was like, this is amazing.
And you can still guide it. I mean, you know, like we can tell it to listen, give your answers back in a, you know, in a color and a style that's Conjura branding. And, you know, so you can layer on like sort of overall overarching instructions. So you can sort of nudge it in different directions and still leave it open to your customers to interrogate.
So do you think AI will fundamentally change how you run your business?
Ah, for sure. Like, I think fundamentally how, I mean, obviously there's the AI side of how we do our work under the hood, but I mean, what our product actually does and how it works, I think it's going to be massively different. And like, if you remember, all of this is based on the underlying data set. So, you know, you'll have a Shopify AI agent, but that only has the Shopify data. You have the Conjura AI agent that has Shopify and eBay and Walmart and Meta and Google Ads. And so the better the data under the hood, the better the answer you get. Mm. You know, so it's proprietary data set that's going to drive the value.
But surely that makes Conjura infinitely more valuable.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the AI will only be as good as the data it has.
Yeah.
If it talks to me every day for like, let's say 30 minutes, right? If I'm driving home, I'll often have full-blown conversations with it. So if it talks to me every day for 30 minutes, if I talk to you every day for 30 minutes, you know me really well after the year.
Yeah.
And also with AI, you can be very honest.
Yeah.
You can kind of say the things that you're like, random question, but, you know, so I don't understand your true motivations. So for you, with your data set of like millions and millions of data points on every single business, surely this makes, you know, companies like Conjura very, very valuable.
Yeah. And like, I think the other thing that we probably need to do is, and just because we're almost going back to the cycle at the start. So we're looking now at the questions the best operators ask.
Yeah.
And we're going to have to tell the weaker operators, these are the questions you need to ask AI. You know, when I said we were building custom solution back in the day and we looked at the best dashboards that, you know, our customers were building or asked us to build, now we're looking at the best questions they're asking AI. Because you're going to have the same issue. You're going to have some brands are going to go, well, I don't know, Fran, I don't know what to ask. Like, what should I say to the AI?
And then when you can ask anything, where do you start?
Yeah. And then, you know, you can say, look, why don't you ask it what products you need to reprice, you know, in Amazon, or ask it what products you need to remove from the ad feed into Meta, you know, those kind of questions.
I was actually thinking last week, I was watching The Overlap. I love that podcast. So it's Gary Neville's podcast.
Right,
yeah. I love it. And being a podcast nerd, I'm always watching what everyone else is doing, but I'm more interested in like what lights, what mics, and behind the scenes. And I was gripped.
Yeah.
Showed you like how often they record the studio and they're kind of like going into the green room. I think there's like 30 people working on the show.
Wow.
So you can see there's only 28 of us here, right? Yeah. Ben is worth 27. So like there's, you know, and I was thinking, right, how can I level up this to be a world-class podcast but without like all the overheads of the people, and I was like, it'd be really cool, and I actually think I'll do this as an experiment to have AI listening, almost like the producer.
So
if you watch The Overlap, you can't see it unless you're really clued in. Gary Neville has an earpiece.
Okay.
So he's a producer in his ear all the time.
Okay.
And they started slagging him about it, going, oh, I gotta really love the answer because producer Jeff will have told him, you know, and they're all kind of giving him, taking the piss out of him. But I was like, how amazing would it be to be able to, like, you know, have a producer in your ear who's listening to all our talks and able to go, actually, can you, that was 1997, can you go back and ask about this?
Yeah.
It's hugely powerful.
Yeah, amazing.
And it's now interesting. It's great to get talking to someone like you because there's a lot of, like, hand-waving in AI.
Yeah.
There's a lot of, and we talked about it earlier, about people who get up on stages and kind of, like, say vague stuff.
Yeah.
You're using AI. Yeah. Is it good? Yeah. That's kind of the, okay, cool.
Yeah, and like I'm skeptical, and I really need to see the exact use case to really.
Yeah.
And I now see, oh my god, yeah, you're going to be able to just take all those jobs and get them done immediately. That's incredible. I need to see it to believe it really as well.
Oh, I think show me, don't tell me.
Yeah,
I'm very much that kind of like. I'm very much. I need to see it to kind of. I get it now. I don't really understand.
Yeah.
But like. Even like simple things like how the pod is produced and stuff, like we're like moving to a new platform now that just allows us to host everything there.
Yeah.
Whereas before, like pod version one was just audio only.
Yeah.
So we just hosted, it was just an audio file. And that was kind of it. There was no richness to it. And now it's like this version two, you sit now with video. And like version three then is probably hyper personalization. So people will probably be able to talk to us after the fact.
Yeah.
So I think me and you will have this conversation, and I think this is going to get more valuable for me. The question you didn't ask, but I'll ask myself, is like, what does it mean for podcasts? Is like, I think for stuff like this gets more valuable. The in-person stuff gets more valuable, but then it's after the fact, what can we do? But I think it's someone who's an e-com brand owner and they can ask you questions through the podcast. I think it'll be amazing.
Yeah.
So they can sit down and they can actually talk on our episode.
For sure. Yeah.
And they can get like, they can kind of collate. And this is what I'm thinking about doing with all the past episodes, is putting them all into a giant learning machine. Because I get pinged questions every day from listeners. And I'm like, no, I'm not the smart one. The smart one was on the podcast 2 months ago. I was like, you need to go DM them and ask them this question.
Yeah.
Someone asked me the other day, where do I source this? I was like, I haven't an absolute clue. I was like, but here, go talk to Fran, whoever it is.
Yeah.
But I think how cool would it be if you can actively chat to you.
Yeah.
Without having to ping you to go, can I meet you for a coffee?
Yeah.
You know, you can actually chat to you through the episode. Yeah. Like it is fascinating.
Amazing.
It is going to be a whole new world. This is the question I can't kind of figure out. How soon does this start to impact our daily lives?
You mean in e-commerce or in general?
Both, kind of, really. Like, so, I mean, you're seeing both, right? And you obviously dabble quite a bit with AI and stuff. Like, because I think it's only when it really starts to, you know, you start using it every day, almost without thinking. So I'll use ChatGPT every day. I'll talk to it every single day. And that's good. But, you know, when I'm able to kind of go, hey, ChatGPT, so today's episode, I actually need to go and do this, this, and this, and this, and this. That's different. So when do you think we'll start to actually use it like fundamentally every single day, all day?
It's a good question. Like, I mean, I think it's still very based on the person, but, you know, it will be like your personal assistant and you'll say, hey, remind me to phone that person later. Or remind me to email a person. It'll be just like you're talking to somebody who's taking notes and then you can obviously say, hey, you know, top up my bin charge or, you know, whatever you want to do in tasks. It'll be able to just go and do that. It'll log in and do that. So I think that's, you know, months away rather than years.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, it's...
Now, that'd be amazing because it's so interesting that now when I use Alexa, I get really frustrated. Really, really frustrated because you see the difference is night and day.
Yeah.
Alexa's like using a cassette player and you've got like, you know, the latest, you know, Netflix over here.
Yeah.
You're kind of going, I just want you to play the top 40
in
Ireland and shuffle them for me.
Yeah.
Here is the Beach Boys. And you're like, no. It's amazing. And it's kind of surprised me that Amazon has kind of seemed to have slipped behind on this development and stuff. Because surely Amazon makes such sense. It's like, hey, Alexa, here's the question for this. But also now follow up with an action.
Yeah.
Because like we said, the information without the action is pointless.
Yeah. And I think Google will have an edge because, you know, so many of these platforms you log in via your Gmail account or whatever. They might have the access to the ability to log in, you know, so you can say, hey, you log into my electricity account and top up or whatever you want to do.
But where do you see this actually? That's an interesting point. Like, you know, the way like Google, Meta, like these super companies have such kind of a moat and now Elon's trying to build it with X. like they had such a moat, but where do they sit now in the AI space? Like, you know, if I want to check something now, I just hit the ChatGPT button and I talk to them. Whereas with Google, I don't use it as much.
Yeah. Like, I think the application, I mean, Google, but YouTube has a lot more knowledge of the videos maybe you watch. So yeah. Like, it depends probably what your area of interest is. If you're big into, you know, any video content, and maybe Google's model will be better because they know more about you. Yeah, it'll be, it's hard to know really. I think it'll probably, yeah, they'll probably be better at different stuff.
It's a good point on the video, yeah, actually. And I was thinking, again, within the videos, it'd be cool if you can search for an exact moment. Because yeah, sometimes when I'm listening to a podcast, I'll be driving and I'll be like, oh, that's a really good point.
Yeah.
And then I get home.
Yeah.
The brain is like 52 other things it's thought of since, and it's completely forgotten at what point it'd be class to be able to kind of go, hey, remember when Fran mentioned that thing? Go back, yeah, and find that for me. Yeah. Can you play that?
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah.
And totally. It seems, yeah, pretty straightforward, right?
Yeah, like, it's moving at such pace. It's,
yeah.
Yeah.
Because at the minute, like, we put up clips, right? So we'll pick like clips from this episode and we'll pick what we feel is nice.
Yeah.
But like, if you had like, I was only thinking about this yesterday, if you're having like hundreds of clips going up all the time, just,
yeah,
cycling through until it finds the one going, oh, that's the most interesting bit. Fran said this and people love that.
Totally. Yeah.
Because content is changing as well. Like the algorithms, you made a good point there about the algorithms changing after COVID. I can see the algorithms changing a lot now because before it used to be your followers, right? Oh, how many followers do you have? And you'd have 50,000. Oh, deadly. Whereas now, like, we have nearly 70,000 on both TikTok and then 70,000 on Insta, give or take. And we can put up, like, we'll put up two videos every single day.
Yeah.
Without fail. So it's 14 videos a week on each platform. And like 12 of those might get like 5,000 views, and two of them might do 500,000 views. That's wild.
Yeah.
Like,
how do you,
it's all driven by that initial 20, 30 minutes.
Yeah.
Are people engaging with this? Are people commenting going, he's dead right, he's dead wrong?
Yeah.
That's really interesting. So like the content, everything falls within the content now. So you can have a new business, a new company, and they can go viral with like their second post.
Yeah.
Like, it's incredible times.
It's so hard to predict as well, isn't it? As well.
But that's the exciting thing. Yeah. I suppose for companies, that's the most infuriating thing. And I guess that's where you come in again, because we're still doing it by hand. Like, we're going through, we only did it last week. That's why it's fresh in my mind. We went through all the last 50 clips that have gone like viral, you know, anything above 200,000 plays, and making like, you know, making notes to say, this is what was in the clip, this is why we think I'm going to viral. But like, if you can have analysis of that.
I think a good analogy, right? So in e-com, the algorithms now do everything. So you used to have a lot more dials. You know, if you were sending, in Google, for example, you'd say, hey, look at people of this age group in this country and this. Now you sort of just give your product catalog to Google and just say, you go find the best people, and I trust your algorithm will do better than me prompting you to do anything. But the key is now, if you have 100,000 SKUs, do you give Google 100,000 SKUs to experiment with, or do you cut it down? And we in Conjura would be very much focus on your best products and let Google do the work after that. So don't, like, be like, for you, don't give the algorithm all your videos, you know, give it the what it thinks are the best 50% of the videos, and then let it do its thing.
Okay.
So you need to probably control some elements at the start.
Is that what's going to become e-com owners' primary job, is the curation? Are they going to become primarily about like having less products but better? Or where do you see the value? Because if everything's automated, right?
Yeah.
What's the human's edge?
Yeah, this is what we're like, again, we look under the hood and we say, oh my God, you know, you've 1,000 products feeding into Google. 20% of the spend is on a bunch of products that generate no revenue. So Google is testing, cycling through, and you know, these products are, you know, your worst products. You need to take them out of the whole feed altogether because you don't want it to be training on those. So yeah, there's an element of, you know, and maybe this becomes self-learning over time, but you need to be smarter with what information you give algorithms at the start.
Okay.
That's the day we're at in right now.
Just crap in, crap out, right? If you give it crap data, it's going to give you crap back. It's going to give you probably the best educated guess on the crap data. Whereas if you're feeding it good.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. That's interesting. Yeah.
So a lot of it's going to be automated, but it's up to you to feed it on the best.
Yeah. So right now it's still about, you've got to be smart feeding, you know, and I think over time, maybe you don't need to do that. Maybe it's more learn self-learning, but yeah.
So for ecom owners in 2025, right, how do you pick out the signal from the noise? Because we've talked a lot there about all the different things that can happen. So at the very start, you made a really great point about people focusing on the wrong thing.
Yeah.
You know, I think a lot of us are guilty of that because either we kind of want to focus on the wrong thing or we're kind of comfortable with like, oh, look, the downloads are going up. But how long is the retention, Gary? I started working with a mentor in the UK and he gets me to pull the data every Monday morning now.
Yeah.
And it's quite a racing start to the week. You know what I mean? But I'm 4 weeks in. It's fascinating. Yeah. So I used to pull them monthly. Right?
Okay.
I'd pull the data monthly. Mm-hmm. But now every week I'm like, oh, that's really interesting. Because immediately we can go back in and I can ping Lauren and go, hey, Lauren, this week this was happening. Why? You know, so for you kind of seeing this on the back end and then for e-com owners who are listening, what are the key signals they need to be looking for in 2025?
Yeah, so I guess I haven't operated. So, you know, operators might be screaming at this podcast, but I think e-com or retail is... there's no silver bullet. There's 1,000 lead bullets. So it's all small tasks, a lot of small tasks all the time. So you've got to be on top of everything in terms of, you know, monitoring refund rates, monitoring repurchase rates, monitoring margin, monitoring, you know, how much money are you making when you're discounting? You've got to just really be monitoring everything so that if something is dropping, you can address it. So it's almost like a prioritization exercise. Where if you're all over the metrics all the time, you know where the problem is.
So the devil is in the detail.
Yeah, I think you just, if you have a good system in place that flags when something is slightly, you know, performing poorly, or even if it's performing well, maybe you double down on it. You need to find out fast so you can react.
Yeah, okay. So it's being able to, I suppose, pattern recognition, right?
Yeah, just the, pattern recognition and... be as fast as you can to react to something.
So what's exciting you now? What are you kind of buzzed about as we kind of like go into the second half of this year?
Like definitely the AI stuff with Conjura. So, you know, I think what it means for us is that, you know, soon, like it's not only will you get insights from Conjura, but you'll be able to automate the task on the back of the insight. And that makes us way more embedded in our customers. You know, and don't get me wrong, we have customers who love our products and use it all the time, but I'd just love to be absolutely integral on all the jobs being done all the time. And that's, for me, it's a completely, it opens up a completely new world for us of, you know, more automation. So that's what's exciting me.
And then when it comes to like what e-com, like what's coming? What are you kind of looking at going, oh, we're seeing this again and again and again? What are the kind of hot things that you're seeing coming that you're like, I think this isn't a fad. It's more like a permanent thing that's actually really going to stay.
Yeah, so it's back to what we sort of chatted about earlier, the fragmentation side. So, you know, again, like China, you're going to sell on more and more and more places. You know, you're going to sell your product in 20 different places. You could be selling it on WhatsApp soon. You know, who knows where you're going to be selling it. So, what that means for a retailer or an e-commerce brand is more complexity, more things to monitor, which is good for Conjura because we're going to be all over it. But it's more complexity and more need to be in the detail. You know, that's where the future is heading.
Okay. So what is, before we get to our quick fire round, sneak another question in. What's massively overrated in e-commerce and what's massively underrated?
Ooh. Good question. I think what's underrated is how hard it is to make money. So, you know, we see this all the time. It's, if you think about it, like retail is competitive on a global scale and you've got to, you know, you build in into your gross margin, you build in the ability to have rent and employ people and have shipping fees and have ad spend and all of that operational stuff costs money. And, you know, at the end of the day, you need to make enough money to actually make a profit, but not charge too much so that your competitor comes in who's a bit more efficient and actually can underprice you. So it's a fine line between I think balancing all the stuff that's going on, charging the right amount, make sure you make money, but don't charge too much and make too much profit because you're probably susceptible to competitors coming in. So it's a really tough business, you know, and I know everyone says retail is hard and you've had a lot of retailers in here, but boy, it's tough whether you're online or in bricks and mortar. It's just...
What's overrated then? What do people focus too much on?
What's overrated? That's a good question. I don't know. I have no answer. Really,
the underrated is a good point. Like how hard it is. I think people, and you made a great point earlier about, you know, during COVID, it was just people spinning up businesses left, right, and center, and everything became like a commodity. Everything was just the same. Like especially like fitness apparel, for example. Like it just became so competitive. All these incredible new brands came out. They're all kind of doing the same thing. The suppliers are kind of the same. And all these tools came out where you could like trace back where like Gymshark and all these kind of companies were getting their products and then people were just going to the same factory. It really was becoming a race. I think that's why branding is going to become so, so powerful.
Yeah. And I do think one thing, like, you know, you touched on social and it could be an amazing unlock for brands, but like it really doesn't fit everybody. So I definitely come across some merchants who think, you know, it's now time to do TikTok and it's going to work. You know, maybe if you're selling something that's not TikTok ready, it's not going to work for you. So just don't worry about it. Mm. I think that there's a bit of a fashionable thing to do, you know, I need to go into TikTok. I need to go into Instagram, but it might not work for you just based on your product. So, but it, you know, you feel pressure to do it, I guess is the,
Overrated following the trends. For sure. I think so. And like, we're all guilty of that because you don't want to miss out. Like, because, you know, you hear all these stories of like, oh, you know, it's early days now in certain platforms. And it is. And I can see it. There is huge leverage to be had. But if you're right for that platform, Roy from Mystery Shirt in the Box was in. He was like, Instagram is everything for us. TikTok just didn't work.
Yeah.
Our clients just weren't resonating and they weren't there. He was saying that like the female beauty products are flying, but stuff the same towards men isn't having the same performance right across the board, which is really interesting.
Sure.
Like stuff like Conjura will kind of like bring that to the fore. Okay, quick fire round.
Yes.
What book has the most impact on you?
Well, you're going to laugh at this. I have a pile of books by my bed and my wife wonders when I'll ever read them. So
just keeping the lamp up there. They're just the perfect height to keep the lamp there.
I mean, like I was very influenced pre-Conjura by books like Feenomics and, you know, Black Swan by Nassim Taleb. It's almost matching data with pattern, you know, consumer human behavior. So they would have been influencing me. But in terms of now and entrepreneurial stuff, it's more podcasts for me. I love Acquired, the podcast about, you know, stories of businesses, that kind of stuff. That's where I really focus all my time.
Yeah. It's super interesting. Like, and it's interesting you say that, like, I'm thinking so much about like my own business and the podcast and how does it, you know, how does it change and what does the next version look like? And a lot of it kind of keeps leaning me back towards hyper-personalization and learning, you know, like if you have a question that you need to solve, like let's say when you're raising your round, when you're just about to raise your round, I'm sure all you were trying to figure out was, how does this work?
Yeah.
How do you raise a round?
Yeah.
What happens then? What happens then? So I'm thinking about doing like really deep dives into just super specifics. Mm. Like, right, we're going to get Fran in and we're going to just talk again, a second podcast, 2 hours long, just on raising his round.
Yeah. Like even, you know, things like, do I do a convertible loan note or a safe? Like, you,
exactly. How are you meant to know?
Every time new founder, well, I don't know anything about this. What should I do? You know, they're just the same challenges people have all the time.
Yeah.
That you should really... It should be easy information to get.
Right. You know, that's it. Yeah. I'm definitely going to do a special. Going to do a spin-off within the Entrepreneur Experiment, just deep dives. Yeah. So just in my gut is telling me that, you know, this real deep dive, because I've done hundreds, literally 400 and something stories now. And I love stories. But like when I can get you back in now again in 6 months, 9 months, just data, right? Yeah. We're just doing e-com data. Yeah. That's it.
Yeah.
Like it'll be boring as hell to 99% of people. They won't care. But to 1%, it'll be the most valuable hour and a half they'll ever listen to. So I think there's real, and like when, like there's no limit on this. You know, you can do as much content as you want, but then making it interesting and engaging and relatable and hyper-personalized is kind of I hijacked your answer there, is kind of like where I see the kind of growth. Okay. So Acquired podcast.
Enterprise Ireland helps to support and fund a vibrant startup ecosystem, providing supports, insights, and network connections to the most ambitious Irish startups. From expert advice to raising funding, exploring opportunities in international markets, to strategic planning, Enterprise Ireland is here to support you in those important startup moments. For more information about how Enterprise Ireland can support you on your startup journey, visit enterprise-ireland.com. Enterprise Ireland, helping Irish startups go global. What is your superpower?
I'd say my optimism. So I have this like unwavering belief that it could be obviously bad at times, but mainly I think it's a positive thing that things are going to succeed.
It was a great example you gave me off camera. It was super. I follow the same kind of trajectory. I was like, what's the worst going to happen?
Yeah.
Just give it a shot.
Yeah. I suppose everything to me is almost, and you had Jack Pierce, almost asymmetrical bets. Like, why wouldn't you be in a startup? What's the most can go wrong? Like you could just get your old job back straight away.
It was so funny how much that triggered people.
Yeah.
It was so funny. Yeah. That went quite viral and it triggered the hell out of some people. Easy for him to say, insert excuse here.
Yeah.
It was so funny. Whereas like the entrepreneurs in the comments were like, yeah, he's dead right. I did this and then da 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 da.
Yeah.
It just shows the two different types of people. Like, what daily habit has been the secret to your success?
I think, so I walk the dogs every morning and always listen to podcasts when I'm doing that. And like a lot of the podcasts would be entrepreneurial business podcasts, and definitely gives me time to reflect on the business. And I've got a lot out of that. I think that's, you know, it's the time where you actually just decompress and think about where you're going, what you're doing. So
it's so funny, like, cause it's not tangible. It isn't talked about a lot.
Yeah,
everyone loves these like quick, like, you know, I do this for X minutes per day, and I'm very guilty of falling into that as well. But time to think, just literally.
Yeah.
I had Dan Fox, they've just sold their company, Johnson Hanna, for 50 million recently. And he was saying like one of his days a week was thinking.
Yeah.
He's like, my job is to think. And I was like, yeah, I love that because it's not measurable. We live in such a measurable world. I'm talking to the data guys here, you're probably screaming, but like it's just time to think.
Like sometimes you need, like, and I feel guilty when I do it, is you need to just look at what's happening. Like you need to just go on your competitors' websites, on, you know, just see what they're doing, see what they're saying. See, and that's, you know, it's almost like market intelligence, which, you know, it's hard to deprioritize other tasks to do something like that, which is.
I was interviewing Ray Nolan. And he said, and this just certain things stick with you. He's like, look, CEO's only role is two things. Set the vision, make decision, get the F out of there. That's his summary. And I was like, that's just beautiful.
Yeah.
Because he's dead right.
Yeah. Just get out of the way.
Set the vision. He's like, my red flag for when he looks at a founder, he's like, they're on the tools all the time.
Yeah.
They're in there and they're doing this and they're doing that. He's like, great at the early stages to get it going.
Yeah.
If they're still doing that after a while, they lack the strategic vision to be able to build a big company. I was like, he doesn't bully punches, but he's dead right.
Yeah.
What entrepreneur should everyone be following and looking at in 2025?
It's a good question. Like I this probably is going to overlap with where I would in your question about investing, but I think Amy Connolly and Sculpted by Amy is, you know, a phenomenal entrepreneur. Incredibly ambitious and bootstrapped, like to... I'd say it's the most impressive Irish e-com brand right now. It's incredible. Yeah,
that episode with her performed really well. What if you're going to invest 1 million euro in one person, one company, who is it?
It'd be Sculpted by Amy, although she wouldn't take the money. I'd say
that's gonna say good luck with that. You're getting your time machine maybe back 8 years. If you're starting from zero again in 2025, what would you build?
It's a great question. I've occasionally come across businesses that have, I would say, like win-win business models, and they're very, very rare. But if I try and find one, and I have seen one recently that, like, essentially you win and your customer wins. So it's absolute no-brainer. Like Hostel World would have been one. You've got hostels who couldn't sell out their hostel, and Hostel World who are, you know, selling software. So I sell you my software, I make money, you fill up your hostel. Why wouldn't you buy it?
Yeah.
So when you come across businesses like that every now and again, you're just going, oh my gosh, this cannot lose. Like, you know, outside of maybe some competition, but yeah, so it's, that's the golden goose of any entrepreneur, is that kind of business.
Where going to give us any tangibles? Going to give us any specifics? People can go off and run off and start.
No,
today?
I think the one I was there's one I've seen recently. It's in the insurance space, but it is like a win-win on both sides, and it's, you know, it's just going like, this thing has to work, because you know, you couldn't not go with the solution.
Great, I'm going to find out off camera now what that is. Get the jump on everybody. What do you believe other people strongly disagree with or find weird?
This is a kind of a weird one, but it's more sports psychology. I play a lot of golf, and I'm always like trying to wrestle with golf psychology. So, there's one Bob Rotella phrase, which is, by and large, people become what they think of themselves. I think it's like, if you're believe you can be successful and an entrepreneur, sometimes you just make it happen. If you believe you can be a good golfer, or, you know, it's half the battle sometimes. So, it's that sort of pigeonholing yourself can hold you back a lot.
The psychology piece. Yeah. I was listening, there was a great interview, I was at the retreat, and they interviewed Henry de Bromhead, the champion trainer. I'm not in horse racing at all, but just, I love sport, I love elite sport, love people who are operating at that level. And he was so down to earth, but he said this one thing, and it stuck with me, and then talking to people, it stuck with him as well. He's like, if you don't believe it, how is anyone else going to believe it? And they were just asking about, how do you deal with like Michael O'Leary and people like that? And he was like, I was held back early in my early days because I wasn't really sure of myself. He's like, you just have to, if you don't believe in it, how the hell are you asking someone else to give you their most prized possession to then go and make them a champion? He's like, you have to believe it or no one else will. So like, it's easier said than done, obviously.
Oh,
it is. Yeah, it's easier for us to say, oh, you know, just believe in yourself, go chase your dreams. And this will probably do well on TikTok. Yeah. But it's true though. Like, you know, it's like the time for thinking, you know. Very rarely are these silver bullets. It's the lead bullets you talk about. It's the boring stuff that you have to do every day. You have to get up and reinvigorate yourself to go, today you're going to build whatever.
Yeah.
What's been your worst investment?
So probably I did pharmacy when I left college. So I did a degree in pharmacy and worked in pharmacy. And like in hindsight, it was just a bad investment in my time and effort, because
interesting,
I loved maths. I didn't follow my passion. I'd say I made a kind of a safe decision in terms of a career, and you know, quickly enough realized that this isn't really where I want to be. So
love it. Yeah, good for you. I think people go through their whole lives making a decision and never reverse back out of it.
Pivot out. Yeah,
especially in pharmacy, you're kind of, you're on that lane and you're guaranteed. What's been your best investment?
So I know there's obviously, you could say I have a great wife and I have a great company that I founded, but I'd say genuinely, golf from a young age has been, you know, a sport that's given me so much in terms of network and friends and contacts, but also like the relaxation and decompression of, you know, busy lives and just switching off. So taking up golf and playing it has been a huge part of my life, I'd say, and amazing. It's been great.
Love that answer.
Yeah.
It was genuine and surreal.
Yeah.
Just got back into golf during COVID, and now our daughter's only two, so I kind of like, I'm training every day. So see the training and the golf, so I was like, right, when she's a little bit older, I'll go back in the golf. It's just so peaceful.
Yeah.
It's definitely the most relaxing thing I think I can ever do.
And I'm incredibly competitive person, and it gives me an outlet for that as well, which is
you need that.
You do, you know, sometimes you just need to scratch that itch. Yeah
100%. So what's the best piece of advice you've heard in the last 12 months?
I think that, like, I met a CEO of a big business recently who's kind of, we're trying to partner with, and he's definitely, he leads in his own style. Like, he's a very, very cool guy. And
love that.
You know, definitely reassured me, like, you've got to do your own style as a leader, as a CEO. Just not try and become something that you're not. Embrace your own personality, you know, whether it's your sense of humor or whatever. When you're running a company, to lean into that and not try and be somebody else.
I love it. Yeah. Lead in your own style. That's really nice. Where can people learn more about yourself and Conjura?
I'm on LinkedIn, so you can contact me on that. And then Conjura, conjura.com. Again, we're on sort of all the social channels, but feel free to reach out, and either directly in the website or reach out to me on LinkedIn, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
So any e-com retailers, kind of 5 to 100 million, get in touch.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Savage. Fran.
Great.
That was a pleasure.
Thank you, Gary.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Sweet.